Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In a normal year, children would be starting back to school. This year, some will, some won't, and parents, teachers, and school systems all face tough choices. But what do we know about what works to help kids, whether they're in school or not? Here's my 2019 conversation with David Kirk, professor at UC Berkeley. His books include The Sandbox Investment and Kids First. And we talk about innovative programs that make a big difference in kids' lives and deserve to be invested in and expanded nationally. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with David Kirk. He's a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He's the author of or contributor to 17 books, including Kids First. And to learn more, you can go to berkeley.edu and search for David Kirp. That's K-I-R-P. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview about every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist, etc. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. A quick plug for participation. As I said, I started doing these again after Trump's Electoral College victory, and so I love people to get involved in resisting the worst of the Trump administration and pushing and working for the healthy, just society we all need. Some organizations that can help you do that are indivisibleguide.com, indivisibleguideoneword.com, and ourrevolution.com. They're both national organizations. Our Revolution grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. And then two organizations, one national and one California, that focus on digital but are working closely with grassroots as well are MoveOn.org and CourageCampaign.org in the state of California. The last time I interviewed David Kirp, which was in July 2011, 7.5 years ago, I began my intro with these lines: what's good enough for a child you love? What's good enough parenting? Good enough early education? Good enough health care? Good enough schools? Good enough support for college? And I told you that Kirk recommended that we develop our nation's children based on a simple but powerful golden rule: every child deserves what's good enough for a child you love. Now, a lot has happened since then. Obviously, school and college budgets have continued to erode until we've seen strikes from Kentucky to Los Angeles. Bullying and racism are on the rise since Trump's election. The college debt burden is still crippling and dangerous, as is the screen addiction of young kids. Children are separated from their parents and lost track of at the border. And I assume that David Kirp still holds that vision. Every child deserves what's good enough for a child you love. And I feel kids can certainly use our attention these days, and that's why I want to talk with him. David Kirp is a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He taught at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, was founding director of the Harvard Center on Law and Education. He served on President Obama's transition team. He's a former associate editor of the Sacramento Bee and a syndicated columnist. His books include The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement, and Kids First Politics, Shakespeare, Einstein, and The Bottom Line, The Marketing of Higher Education, Kids First, and Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. Welcome again, David Kirp, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, January 30th, 2019. Welcome, David.
It's great to be here.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we're going to talk about. So can you tell us, in your own words, a bit about your path to the work you do today? Feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. You know, I can see that you've been a journalist as well as a scholar, as well as an author and so on. So how do you see your path?
Well, it's an interesting question. Nobody's asked me that before. I really stumbled into this field in a way. I was interested in education from way back when. And I'm not sure what it was that got me interested in the subject other than a real love for kids. And I went to law school at Harvard, At the paper chase time, when I guess it was a miserable experience, and I was taking a course in urban law with a hapless professor, but he pointed me to a guy named David Cohen. David was at the Harvard Education School. He had just come from a year at the Civil Rights Commission, where he wrote a report on race and racism in American schools, and that was the turning point. David became my mentor. We had a kind of Oxbridge tutorial that we met once a week at a local cafe, and I wrote and he critiqued, and I wrote and he critiqued. And out of that came an article about school finance and the Constitution. There's very, very little written about or thought about education policy beyond the litigation that had to do with liability for the Bunsen burner exploding in the chem lab. So that article appeared in the Harvard Education Review. It was a time when the federal government was pretty generous about sloshing around money. That Center for Law and Education was established. There was nobody else around to run it, and so David and the professor at the law school picked me to do so. It was supposed to be a research center. Then it shifted. The federal government decided what it wanted really was an organization that could help the then vibrant legal services program bring major lawsuits and draft legislation. It's amazing to think about it that the federal government was funding litigation to sue the federal government. Imagine.
Yeah.
And we did. We brought some of the big cases. I mean, these were the days when kids with special needs were being excluded. They used to call it excused from school, and Latino kids were being penalized if they spoke Spanish during recess on the playground. School finance was woefully misdistributed among school districts. It was a very, very, very different time. So we were able to do a lot on all those fronts. I was so over my head in that job. I was all of 24 years old,
right,
running an organization with 10 lawyers. I was so over my head that I didn't know how over my head I was, which is what saved me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a call from Berkeley and was asked, are you interested in teaching at the public policy school? And I said, what's public policy? And the question to which I still don't have a good answer. And I thought, well, this is another 3-year gig. And that was then, this is now. I've been there for a good long time. I've always been interested in journalism. I used to do a syndicated column for the Christian Science Monitor, then decided I wanted to take off and find out what journalism full-time was about. Wound up working at the Sacramento Bee under another mentor named Peter Schrag, who's written a lot about education. And Peter had me writing and rewriting and rewriting, and I was doing an editorial a day and a column a week, which, looking back, was a lot of work to be done. Came back to Berkeley and got interested in a whole variety of social issues, including AIDS, which then was also not a policy topic. That was the time when Ronald Reagan had even refused to mention the word. And then wrote about, you know, the ways in which communities were excluding poor families and what you could do about that, all focused on narratives, all stories that meant something beyond their particulars, and all framed in a very loose way in terms of the social science research that was done. You could read the book without knowing that. It was a good, you know, these books are good reads, I hope. They don't put people to sleep like a lot of academic stuff does. I found myself writing about early education, another accident of a walk on the beach and somebody saying, this is big, big research, you know, study involving preschool kids. And, you know, by now they follow these kids. They're in their late 20s and they're doing amazingly well compared to kids who hadn't had that experience. And I thought, wow. And eventually I wound up writing about that, and the rest is kind of history. The Sandbox Investment, which is that book, led me to a position on the Obama transition team where I worked on, I was responsible for the early education portfolio and the community schools portfolio, wrote Kids First, which you mentioned before, and out of Kids First came an interest in the way in which one school district that I found, a place called Union City, New Jersey, which is an almost all Latino school district just across from New York City, a social light year away, how they were doing remarkably well and what lessons there were for America. And now, because of another colleague, a guy named Hank Levin, who teaches at Columbia, I found myself looking at the higher education issue, what good things were happening and why kids were dropping out. And there's a book in the works that will be published in the fall. This is an early plug for a dropout scandal that Oxford will be publishing this fall. And so there I am, continuing to work, looking at some new topics, and also proposing to write a kind of question and answer book about the big policy issues in American education.
Okay, that's the voice.
Pretty windy, but I hope it covers the terrain.
No, that's what I want. We're talking for an hour. This is not your often 8-minute or 10-minute interview, so we have time to find out who you are and how you got here. Now, as I mentioned the book Kids First, because I was very impressed by it for a couple of reasons. One, you put out, you say these are 5 big ideas which can transform kids' lives and America's future, and what those ideas are. And then you showed us programs that you'd found that were already working successfully in these different areas, and why couldn't we do more with those? So I would like to start by following up on some of those ideas and programs in Kids First. As I said, that was 7.5 years ago. And the key 5 priorities in the subtitles, you turn them, those big ideas for transforming children's lives and America's future, if they were true then, I assume they would still be true today. And what they were was strong support for new parents, high-quality early education, linking schools and communities to improve what both offer children, in a term that's become known as community schools, but those are schools that see their job as more than just functioning in the hours that kids would normally be taking classes and actually serving their entire communities. Then giving all kids access to a caring and stable adult mentor. And then finally providing kids a nest egg to help pay for college or kickstart a career. Now, those were the ideas that you posed in that book. Are those still the 5 big ideas, or have something been supplanted, or has something been found not to be as meaningful or as much a contributor to success? So my question is, are those still the 5 big ideas, and why are those 5 the ones that you settled on?
So let me add one other idea. Great. Which is an affordable college education and high-quality training program. So I stopped quite deliberately at high school, and there were 5 ideas. There were others that I thought about, including the idea that all kids should be exposed to a foreign language. It's a kind of scandal in this country that Americans tend to speak nothing but English and assume the world is going to understand them. Let me tell you about the impetus for that book. When I was on the transition team, scores of people came to see us. And it was a small team, so lots of us would tag team in other programs and listen to these people. And they were all well-intentioned. And the problem was, from my point of view, was they weren't looking at the whole kid. They were slicing and dicing children. So you had the Catholic schools, and you had the Indian education, and you had free speech organizations and groups that cared about little kids and so forth and so on. And all of those are important concerns, but none of them really dealt with kids writ large. And I thought, well, let's step back and think about what we want. And again, it's not as though those programs aren't important, but they need to, if they fit, a strategy that really is designed for all kids. That's what I was aiming for. And so to work through those ideas one by one, I think I would say overall there has been incremental progress. I would say it is mostly at the state level. Of late, I would say it's despite rather than because of the Trump administration, which has been anti-kid, certainly anti-college, in lots of ways. So support for parents. There are programs that really help parents learn how to do parenting at its best. And I begin the book by saying parents are kids' primary educators. This is where kids learn the most, and particularly early on. And as we know, early on is crucial in brain development and social development before children, you know, even young children are in school. So in some places, there have been modest funding increases. The new California budget that Gavin Newsom has put out has modest additional funding for those programs. But we're still a long ways from providing this kind of help. And the focus has been on poor families. And there's no particular reason for this. I don't know any parent of a first child who thinks, I've got it nailed. I understand exactly how I should do, and I don't think that's an issue for just poor families. And you look at France, everybody, including the prime minister and the prime minister's wife, get a visit early on to help them down that road. So we haven't done enough. We've made, you know, inches of progress. On early education, there are substantially more kids in preschool, four-year-olds in particular, three-year-olds less so. And the problem, there are two problems. One is the fact that, again, the programs have targeted poor kids. And what people don't realize is that middle-class kids come to school as far behind as wealthy kids, as poor kids come to school behind middle-class kids. And there are actually there are more middle-class children than there are poor children. So you could say the numbers really are, you know, the numbers argue for providing universal pre-K, which has ceased to be on the agenda. I just wrote a piece for the San Francisco Chronicle arguing that we need, that's what we need. Whatever happened to the idea of universal pre-K? This was one of Hillary Clinton's campaign themes. The other big problem is quality. We're spending much too little on preschool. There are lots of people who still think that early education is kind of babysitting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that means you get teachers who are barely qualified. They've got good hearts, but not enough training in how to think about four-year-olds and how different they are from three-year-olds. If they're in the public school system, they get paid decent salaries, but in many cases, they're working for community organizations. They're getting paid a pittance. They don't have health benefits. They don't have retirement benefits. And it's no surprise that they come and go with great speed.
Mm-hmm.
So at a time when kids need education the most, they're getting it the least. And it really irks me when people say, well, we can't afford to do more. And I say, you know, what does can't afford mean? It means that early education and little kids are not a priority. And in that Chronicle article, I made a half-serious, half-Jonathan Swift kind of argument, which is, okay, here's how we afford preschool. We just get rid of senior year in high school. You know, the only reason you got senior year in high school is inter-high school sports, football. You know, kids want to be out of there. And by the way, some legislators took that idea seriously. And the point isn't necessarily that that's what you want to do, but to say, you know, if you look around, if you look at what we're spending on, say, prisons, think about there is money around if there's the will to spend it.
And one, this notion that you've mentioned two or three times, which is all kids rather than just poor kids. One argument for that is the one that you've already made, which is that middle-class kids are as disadvantaged relative to the wealthy as poor kids are to the middle class. Okay. But the other argument is that when you focus a program on the poor, then people are much less likely to favor it. Roosevelt saw this with Social Security. The reason that Social Security is not means tested, the reason that everyone gets Social Security and everyone gets Medicare is because if a program is for everyone, then you can't divide and conquer in terms of support. So I think that is one of the reasons that you favor that as much as possible, programs should focus on all children. Is that correct?
Yeah, and let me add the famous line from one of the pioneers in early education was, programs for poor kids are poor programs.
Mm. Yeah.
And a couple of other things I would add. One is that if to the extent that you can make those programs not separate kids into poor kids and middle-class kids, but you can take advantage of the possibilities of bringing them together, everybody's going to learn more. We have the data that you put kids in heterogeneous classroom, mixed middle-class and poor kids, mixed black and brown and white kids, you do better. And finally, if, you know, it's the point that, a version of the point that you just made, which is if you incorporate middle-class kids, those families aren't going to stand for a third-rate education for
right.
their kids. And they know how to fight. They've got the social capital that enables them to push lawmakers to make something happen. And, you know, this is not a Democrat-Republican issue. It's not a red state-blue state issue. The two leaders in the field are Oklahoma and Georgia. Those are not states that we think about as, you know, the avatars of progressivism. But, you know, if they can afford it, if they're doing it, surely California and other states can afford to do it.
Now, by the way, when you say
New York City just went down this route, and New York City has a fantastic program.
Do you mean the leaders in early childhood, or what specifically?
Yes, the leaders, they are the leader. Those states have high-quality, universal preschool, Georgia and Oklahoma, and that's the route that New York City has just taken as well.
Now, let me ask a quick question, because I'm always fascinated by these sorts of things. You point out that one would not have expected Oklahoma and Georgia to be the leaders in these. How did it happen in one of those states? What's the narrative there of how they've achieved what others haven't, even though you wouldn't assume they'd be the poster kids for it?
Well, they're different routes. In Georgia, there was a candidate for governor, and he was convinced by his advisor, a guy named Jim Carville, who wound up being a major... you know, a major political guru for Bill Clinton. And Carville convinced the candidate that there were two issues that he ought to push. One of them was a free high school education for kids who maintain a B average in school. Those are called Hope Scholarships. And the other was universal preschool, which at the time was a totally unheard of idea. And it worked. In Oklahoma, It was a smart middle-level bureaucrat,
no kidding,
who had worked in early education, who persuaded a legislator who nobody knew much about. He was a country legislator, a very conservative Democrat, to make one little change in the Oklahoma state law. That is, you provided funding for 4-year-olds as opposed to 5-year-olds. And once that happened, universal preschool was in place. And however, what was going on is that a lot of superintendents thought the preschool was a joke. And they really were barely spending any money on the 4-year-olds. And then parents in some districts started saying, oh, my gosh, the kids in eastern, southeastern Oklahoma, which is one of the poorer parts of the state, they were doing well. They were doing as well as the kids in the wealthy parts of Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And the parents in those districts said, hey, you know, you got to stop spending money on football uniforms and start spending it on little kids. And that's how you got high-quality education. You got a kickstart from the lawmakers, and then you got a push from the parents.
And what's some cost-benefit analysis? I mean, it seems to me, right, having just kind of looked at this field for 20... Well, actually, I started out as a school teacher, so I've been kind of watching the field all along. But that people know that there's leverage in investing in young children. People know that the, you know, 0 to 3, 0 to 5 here in California, that's such a critical time. What is some of the cost-benefit analysis of, you know, a dollar spent on preschool, blah, blah, that sort of thing? And my bigger question really is, why can't people see this? In other words, I imagine they see it with their own kids, they see it with their grandkids, but as a society, we don't seem to be able to see this. So the two questions are, what's the cost-benefit and what's the blind spot?
So I want to underscore a point, and that is preschool without quality is kind of worthless. And we have some data on this in which you actually studied that question. You looked at kids who'd gone to good preschools, and the metric that was used was the only metric available, which is how much was spent on those kids. And then kids who didn't go to, you know, good preschools. You look at those kids 12 years later, and there's a big difference in outcome. So we don't talk about quality because it's hard to understand, and it's kind of boring to talk about training of teachers and evidence-based curriculum and the size of classrooms, but that matters. And one of the things I learned from looking at various state programs and writing sandbox investment was it's easier to go from a better program to a bigger one than it is to take a big program and turn it into a better one.
Mm.
So that's not part of the conversation. People talk about preschool, pre-K, as if it were some kind of a unity, but it's not. I mean, if you think about, nobody talks about K-12 that way. Preschool is exactly the same. So it's not the case that people don't get it. If you look at the data, 70% of Californians believe that early education is good for kids and ought to be part of the education system. And that includes about half of the Republicans. So what happens? What happens is those folks haven't organized. Mm. There is no teachers union for those teachers who are going to put pressure on the lawmakers. And so if you listen to the lawmakers, they all love kids. And in fairness, in California, for example, there has been a real push over the years. We had a governor, Jerry Brown, who did many great things, but you talk about blind spots. He thought this was worthless. And his famous line was, you know, I was kicked out of kindergarten, and look how I turned out.
Oh.
Well, that's not very helpful.
Talk about anecdotal, huh?
Yeah, but, and it matters, right? I mean, I think it's not irrelevant that he never had kids.
Mm.
Because everybody that I know who's gotten seriously involved in this starts out by having kids and seeing how their kids benefit as opposed to other kids. And, you know, even the former governor of Illinois, who was a crook and wound up in jail, the one good thing he did was to fund preschool for four-year-olds and set aside some money for two- and three-year-olds. So we now have a governor who's campaigned on early education and whose budget is what I call a down payment for early education. It's much too stingy when it comes to pre-K, and that's what I argued in that Chronicle piece that I've mentioned. It gets, I gave in a piece for the LA Times, I gave it two cheers, the whole program, for the same kinds of reasons. You really need to think about universal pre-K, and that's got to be the goal. So I think there's just a gap between what the voters think and what's happening, because that thinking has not yet translated fully into programs. You know, let's look at what happens over the next 8 years. My hunch is that we'll be doing better. Across the country, those attitudes are the same. And again, you get unequal progress. You get substantial increase in the numbers of kids since I wrote Kids First. But you don't get substantial increase in many places in the amount of money spent on each kid. And if you're spending half as much or less on preschool as you are for K-12, well, what do you expect is going to happen?
Right. And as I noticed, when in those five ideas, the idea that we're talking about here was not early education. It was high-quality early education.
Exactly. And there are two, takeaways that are really important. One is that parents matter, and they matter all the way through this process. It's not as though schools are miracle workers. And the other idea is that quality matters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to jump ahead to the idea that kids need a caring, stable adult. Let's underline the word stable. You know, by and large, a program like Big Brothers, Big Sisters tries to keep the Big Brothers and Big Sisters around for at least 6 months, and they've pushed that to 8 months and in some places 12 months. Why? Because think about the kids who sign up for those programs. Many of them, and anybody can sign up, but many of them are poor kids. They've lived unstable lives. All of a sudden, they've got an adult who they can turn to, and then that adult disappears. What's that going to do for the kids' trust of adults?
Yeah.
And, to jump to that issue. So you ask teenagers, and there's data on this. You ask teenagers, what do they want? They want more contact with adults. We don't think that.
Right.
They want more contact with stable adults. And if you ask people in the field, what's that? And, I'd ask you as well as a former teacher, what's the most important thing you can have in the life of kids? And the answer is a stable, caring adult. It can be a teacher, it can be a minister, it can be a coach, it can be a mentor, but you want somebody who has kids back.
Yeah, I know a program that I've actually, full disclosure, I've done some work for, I've done some communications work for, and that you salute, is Friends of the Children, which is a paid mentor, and one of the reasons they do it is to capture that stability.
And Friends of the Children, I actually sat on the national board of Friends of the Children for a while, and that model is really impressive because it says they identify in kindergarten, they sit in classes, and they look at kids who you can predict, you know, as a teacher and as a parent, you can predict who's going to be a trouble kid. You know, it's the kid that's stabbing other kids with a pencil. It's the kid that threatens to jump out the window. It's the kid that throws chairs in that school. And they find for those kids, with the agreement and support of the parents, they find for those kids mentors. And the mentor doesn't stick around for 12 years, but mentors who are supporting those kids from kindergarten through high school. And that's unheard of. But it's that kind of support. You know, there's no particular reason to believe that only little kids need support.
Oh,
there's,
my
there's
God.
There's no reason to believe
right.
that good education programs are only for elementary school kids.
Right.
Really have to think about children, youth. And not just little kids or short-term Band-Aid
right.
help.
Right. And one thing I know about the Friends of the Children is that it's an expensive program. They're paying someone to spend 4 hours a week with a kid through high school, as you pointed out. But their cost-benefit versus 12 years of mentor versus 12 years of incarceration or 12 years of welfare that's where you see the benefit. And what they found is that when these kids have a mentor, that they're much less likely, they're much more likely to graduate and much less likely to end up in either of those other buckets.
Exactly. And by the way, there's recent research that shows that poor families that have, give poor families food stamps. And people, you know, conservatives say, oh, it's a handout, it's, you know, These are not deserving folks. They ought to be working. The same thing was true for welfare support. You look at the long-term effects, you find substantial difference. And you look at adults who've had that kind of support versus those who didn't, and you find substantial effects, substantial benefits for the kids. So these really aren't programs for grown-ups. They're largely programs for kids. And do we really want to have kids going without meals, you know?
And one of the things that I believe you've written about, but certainly is in the air these days, is this notion of work requirements to receive Medicaid, work requirements to receive food stamps, and the research pretty much shows that what those work requirements do, besides creating bureaucracy and paperwork, both for the government and for the people, is they knock people off of those benefits. And as you point out, when people lose Medicaid or food stamps, the impact on children, their lives, their education for the rest of their life can be terrible. And speak a little to that.
Yeah, most people want to work. For most people, work is one of the things that gives meaning to their lives. So it's not as though, again, you've got lots of folks who are just sitting at home eating bonbons or, you know, driving around in Cadillacs, as Ronald Reagan
used to say,
and Donald Trump actually said during the campaign. A lot of the folks who are not working are folks who can't work. They're in one way, shape, or form disabled. And if you keep those families off the rolls, or you make it really hard them to get benefits, again, it's the kids who suffer.
Right. One of the things, Medicaid and tax credits are more like, the kids, families who receive food stamps, Medicaid, and tax credits, kids are more likely to remain in school, more likely to avoid crime, more likely to be healthier and live longer. And
somebody wanted to start an organization that benefited these families. It'd go out and find the poor families who were entitled to the earned income tax credit, which is one of those, I love it, because nobody knows what that means, the very obscure policy-wallacy kind of name. But it really provides funds for poor families, and the poorest of families typically aren't signed up. And in some cases, just to make the earlier point, you ask why, they say, we didn't earn this, we don't deserve this. So you need to help people understand that it's a right, you know, and it's a right for their kids, not just for them. There are millions of folks who are eligible for the earned income tax credit who are not getting it. And we don't know about that. We could find those families. It would take a big effort, but boy, would it be worth it because of the long-term outcomes that you were talking about.
Right. So it's interesting. It goes back when we asked the early question, why don't people make the investment? It was, well, that people know they need it, but they aren't organized. And in this case, people have even, the policy has passed, the policy exists, and the people who need it don't know about it. So there are gaps here that look fillable that could make a difference. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2019 conversation with David Kirp, professor at UC Berkeley. His books include The Sandbox Investment and Kids First. And we're talking about some innovative programs that make a big difference in kids' lives and deserve to be invested in and expanded nationally. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with David Kirp. He's a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, the author of or contributor to 17 books, including the one we're talking about now from 2010-2011, Kids First. And you can learn more about David's work by going to berkeley.edu and then searching for David Kirp, and it's K-I-R-P. He's a frequent contributor, op-eds, opinion pieces, analysis pieces, and so on. So there's a lot. It isn't, in other words, you go to David's, you find David's work, it's not all going to be academic studies. It's going to be stuff that you can read, understand, and use. Let's talk a little bit about community colleges, which in essence is one of the things that you were advocating for, that schools be more involved in linking schools and communities. There are some successes in that realm. Could you share a little bit about that?
So are we talking about community colleges or community schools?
I meant community schools. My mistake.
Okay. By the way, let me just say something about my own background. I don't think any of it, you know, is academic in the way you're just describing it. And, you know, what I say to folks is, pick up a book, start reading it. If you don't like it, I'll give you your money back. The other thing I would add is that I'm now a contributing writer to the New York Times, so
yeah,
there's a lot of my prose that shows up there, including a recent piece about community schools.
Right.
And when I'm writing an article, you know, there's really three parts to it. Let me tell you a good story, because the seven most irresistible words in the English language are, let me tell you a story. It's actually six words. And so I begin with a story to hook you. Then I show you that it's not just a story. There's some evidence that it works. And finally, it's not a one-off. It's a program that has legs. It's a program that lots of people can pick up and use. And that's always the model. In the book that's going to be coming out, the book about college dropouts, the college dropout scandal, I describe the scandal, and then I say, look at what some universities ranging across the country from Long Beach State to Rutgers, Newark, look at what they're doing and look how successful they're being. So I want to show folks that there are success stories, and they're not, oh my God, they've got so much money, or
right,
oh my goodness,
right,
we couldn't possibly do that. To show folks that none of this, you know, is brain surgery. It's all doable stuff. So the community school, I think about the community school as good preschool for older kids, just adapted for older kids. The classic school is an eight to three school. It focuses mostly on the three R's. That was particularly true during the No Child Left Behind heyday, but it's still the case. So you don't get a whole lot of science or history or any of those subjects. And you don't get, you know, when I was a kid, way back when, you had gym every day. Now many kids have gym once a week.
Mm.
You know, they might have art. They might have music. And their families are just left in the cold. I mean, schools, but the farther up you go in the grade ladder, the more the greater the distance between families and schools, the greater the distrust on both sides of that divide. So community schools really are, as the name suggests, schools that and always serve the community, serve the kids by being open from sunrise to sunset. They often feed them three meals, certainly two meals a day. The after-school programs aren't your classic, programs for kids who are doing catch-up stuff. There's academics there, but all those things that are missing from the regular school, all those programs that are missing from the regular school, the science, the art, the field trips. Remember field trips? All that is built into the community school. There are going to be health clinics either in the school or accessible to the school. And just imagine if you're a parent and your kid gets sick, what do you do? Either you stay home and take care of the child or you spend all day ferrying the kid to a doctor. If you have a nurse on the premises, you can drop the child off. You can go do what you're going to do. You can come back and pick the child up in a safe and caring environment. And community schools also serve parents, and they serve families. I was writing about a school, a community school, that is in the Lower East Side of New York City. Half of the kids are homeless. Half of the kids in that school are homeless. And all those programs that I just described, plus there's a summer program, exist there. As well, for families, kids are short of winter coats. Well, there are winter coats that are provided. Parents want to study they want to do the prep work for being a citizen. They want to learn English. They want to learn computer skills. That's all something that gets provided. So parents' needs are built into the school. There are lawyers that come to the school that help families that are fighting immigration orders. There are psychologists and social workers on the premises because a lot of these kids, you can imagine, particularly in a school like that, that these kids, they're all suffering from trauma. Mm-hmm. They're all suffering from, it's not post-traumatic stress, it's trauma. And you need that kind of help. And it's made, in academic terms, it's made a difference. But in social terms, what are these kids like? There's no instant conversion. There's no instant miracle any place in this child caring, child benefiting world. Working with someone who's trained as a psychologist or a social worker helps teachers in the classroom because they're not addressing that all the time. And over time, it helps the kids. They benefit from that kind of support. And they may have tantrums. What they learn about tantrums is, okay, if I feel a tantrum coming on, they need to chill for a while. So it's okay for them to walk out of the classroom and walk around for half an hour and just let go of what they're feeling and then come back to the classroom. That's a community school. And again, if you think about all those programs, I began the community schools chapter in that book by mentioning a rich family and their teenage son who was going to a fancy prep school, visiting a community school up in East Harlem and Washington Heights, that area of New York City. And he looks around and he says, I wish we had all these things in my school. Again, it's one of those schools that meets my criteria. And every child deserves what you would want for a child you love. Think about that. Yeah. Every child deserves what you want for a child you love. Not the Cadillac version, not necessarily the trip to Paris or the internship with a senator, but the good enough kind of support, the Kia version of that support, which actually is what helps these kids. How could anybody out there think differently about that? And how, if you believe that, look at the implications for all kids.
Yeah. I mean, one thing is that the school exists. There's an investment in the plant. There's an investment in security. There's an investment, right? And to take that, and there's a relationship between this entity existing in the community and families. And so to take advantage of what's there and the relationship that exists already just seems a no-brainer. when you have to give services. I also think that some of what you're describing, libraries now offer more than they used to. And this notion that schools and libraries have a great deal to offer to their communities, that the parents need, that senior citizens need, that immigrants need, that the homeless need, is something that we just don't take enough advantage of.
No, and people say to me, God, how do you pay for that? Well, it costs somewhat extra, but what you discover is there are nonprofits out there that chip in. The health clinic, you know, is going to be serving kids and families. Why not establish a base in the schools? And then you get companies that are doing their bit. Just a plug for the eyeglass company, Warby Parker.
Right.
Warby Parker in New York and elsewhere does free eye exams for all kids, and it provides free glasses for those who need them and can't afford them. You get that kind of support from businesses, and that's just one example.
Yeah.
So there are organizations out there, there are nonprofits out there are other governmental agencies out there are businesses out there. You know, all you got to do is connect the dots. All you got to do is be ingenious about that.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you know, people don't connect the dots.
I mentioned community colleges before, and I guess it was because there's also there's things happening in that realm, and there's been some good innovations recently in California.
Yeah, it's interesting. Community when I was setting out to look at dropouts in school, you know, my head was focused on 4-year colleges and universities because that's what I knew about. And I would say that if you want to see exciting innovations going on, go to community colleges. And I focused in the book on a school in Orlando, Florida, or a school system in Orlando, Florida, that has hooked up with the local university so that any kid who graduates from that community college can automatically transfer that to that university. And I write about City University of New York and how they take students, you know, who somehow pass the GED exams, not the regular high school, but the high school equivalency exams, got into college, and their skills, you know, are so poor that in math they're scared about fractions and negative numbers. And they take those kids, and I watch this, in the course of 3 months, they went from that level of skill to simplifying, you know, complex equations. They were doing the kind of work. They're doing simplifying square roots, kind of work that if you're applying for college or for business school, very same skills are asked for. You're already in the eighth grade. You're already up to eighth grade in those skills. And you know, that begins to get you ready for college. Those kids transfer or move on to a really good 4-year program, which is, again, heavily about support, heavily about, you know, the I have your back kind of people. And they will graduate at the same rate as the community college students who came in not needing that kind of help. And many, many of them go on to 4-year schools. Again, no miracle cure. This is stuff we know, and this is the scandal. We know what to do to help kids succeed at preschool level and at college level. And too often, we are not doing it. We're simply not doing it. The dropout rate, you know, 40% of kids who start university and college don't graduate in 6 years. So those kids wind up with a mountain of debt and nothing to show for it. They are, in terms of their income, they're no better off than if they hadn't started college. And now they're worse off because they've got this debt to pay off. And that hasn't changed, you know, for more than a generation. And meanwhile, we know what to do to move the needle on overall graduation rates. We know what to do to shrink the opportunity gap, and too often it's not happening. So that's the scandal. And again, there are places like Long Beach State. Long Beach is a really interesting story because something called the Long Beach Promise, they have put together in a serious way preschool, the school system, the community college, the university, and the town itself and the city itself. And that works. That makes a huge difference in the lives of kids. Why isn't that going on elsewhere? Well, you know, as somebody in Long Beach said, You know, the adults have to check their egos at the door. And all too often, it's a turf battle that keeps that from happening.
I moved to Long Beach a year ago and have been learning a bit about my community. And what you're saying there, so just so people hear it, it's why that ego remark comes in and that turf remark comes in, is that it is creating a coordination and collaboration between preschool, K-12, community college, and the college, right? And what you're saying is that too often people aren't willing to collaborate with the preschool or collaborate with the community college, and yet everyone loses. The city loses, the kids lose, the families lose, everyone loses if they don't.
So if you look back to the mid-1990s, Long Beach, which had been a very prosperous town, just, you know, went down, you know, down because the Navy pulled out. Now there were no jobs. You know, now you had the middle-class families fleeing from Long Beach, and you had higher crime rates and all the rest of it, and the city folks got together, all those people that you're talking about, you know, and they were talking about community development and business plans, et cetera, and they realized that if you had to do something about the schools. And here are a couple of examples. You know, this isn't just rhetoric. And by the way, when I was there, and I suspect you've picked this up as well, there really is something called Long Beach Pride.
There is.
You know, it's real. It's palpable. So those students, Long Beach State admits Long Beach High graduates with much weaker academic records than students from elsewhere. And the Long Beach High School kids do better at the university than their counterparts who came in with golden records. Here are a couple of other examples. When Long Beach decided to expand its pre-K program, and by the way, the mayor, for him it's a passionate issue. You know, he wants universal pre-K in Long Beach. When they were setting up that program, the community college folks and the university designed a curriculum for them. Those kids are going to visit campuses as early as third grade to get the idea of what college is about. And when there was the serious cuts in funding for K-12 during the Great Recession, teachers were, you know, let go, seniority, last hired, first fired, but teachers in science and teachers in special ed, they were exempted because there were great shortages. So Long Beach State said, if to all of the teachers in that system, if you want to be retrained in one of those fields, we'll do it free. Free. This is Long Beach State is not exactly a rich university. State, you know, the state universities are scrambling to survive financially. So for them to do that, it really is not just talking the talk. It really is walking the walk.
Right.
It's hugely impressive. When I wrote about that, I looked to find other cities that were emulating it, and I couldn't. And, you know, there are some that sort of came sort of close, Modesto being one of those places. But again, you know, ego gets in the way. There's a new superintendent. You know, she wants to do things her way. You know, there's a new community college president, you know, he wants to do things his way, and the whole idea falls apart. It's the stability in Long Beach, the fact that you've got leaders who've come and gone over the years, but the idea, the spirit, the program remains, and it keeps getting better over the years.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, I think part of it happened. The mayor, when this first came into play, had been a school teacher and then had been a school administrator and had been the president of the community college. She had sort of been through all those stages, which no doubt had something to do with them being able to pull this off.
Absolutely. Look, the superintendent of schools now went through that system, got his BA and his PhD from Long Beach State. Well, you know, he's a living example of what it is that we're talking about. I mean, so again, he knows, he understands how important this is. Community college math faculty and English faculty worked with the high school to say, we're getting rid of those exams, those exams that kids take the day they walk in the door to determine where they should be placed in those subjects. We are going to rely on high school grades as our marker of how kids are going to do. Now, that sounds pretty obvious, but college professors can't, they just look down on high schools. The idea that you could actually look at grades and that they would mean something, as opposed to just giving them the kind of tests which they know, you know, in their heart of hearts are going to really work, you know, that's an amazing step. And guess what? A lot of those students got placed in classes more advanced than they otherwise would be, if you look only at test results, mm-hmm. and they have done splendidly.
Whenever I really focus on this issue, I see the good stuff, like we're talking about. We're talking about these, it can be done. It isn't rocket science. It doesn't take more money than God. That's nice, but I really get disheartened. I can only imagine how you, who toil in this all the time, must feel. Why? I mean, the last time I interviewed you in 2011, I said, why isn't this some sort of a national campaign that we, to invest in America is to invest in America's children? You know, is there anything out there that has even the seeds of this where there's like a feel? I mean, we've seen the strikes in West Virginia, in Oklahoma, in Los Angeles. We've seen attention to schools. I think those strikes had something to do with the way the election went in 2018, that people sort of woke up. Is there a movement, or is there the seeds of a movement where we finally say, this is what America needs to do to cope with the 21st century?
So I think it's a really good question, and I think the answer to that question is bottom up and top down. The bottom up are the kinds of teacher strikes you're talking about. It's not as though the teachers in Los Angeles are greedy and said, give us a huge pay increase.
Right.
And they were talking about a difference of 0.5%. You know, it's not trivial, but it wasn't the big deal. The big deal was overtime reducing class size.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you've got a class of 45 kids, again, you know this from your days as a teacher. You know, if you're an English teacher, you know, how many papers a week can you assign if you've got, you know, five classes, each of them has 45 kids? It's pretty awful. So the teacher strike, I think, opened people's eyes, and you're absolutely right. I'm sure that they had an impact on the election. So the top-down, there are two versions of top-down. One is you elect a governor like Gavin Newsom, or you elect some of those teachers. In Oklahoma, some of those teachers, you know, are now sitting in the state legislature where they've got a voice. And there needs to be somebody out there, a national voice, who can speak in a way that attracts nationwide attention. And we don't have that. We don't have anybody close to that. You know, there's nobody in the education world, you know, except that dummy sitting in the education department secretary's chair.
Yeah.
There's nobody who can command a national audience. So that's, to me, that's the other part of the story. Get governors elected and legislators elected who care about these issues. Get teachers mobilized. Get parents at the early education level and teachers at the early education level mobilized. That takes organizers out there in the world to do that. That's what needs to happen. And you know, I'm a realist and I'm an optimist. I have to be both of those things. Otherwise, you know, I'd give up. But, you know, if you're a policy guy, you look for incremental change, and you hope for more.
Yeah.
We'll see. And if I come back in, you know, 3 or 4 years, we'll see what the story is.
The books, again, include Kids First and Improbable Scholars. You can learn more. You can go to the berkeley.edu and search for David Kerp, K-A-R-P. And then the institute that also has some of your stuff, what's the website?
I'm a senior scholar at Learning Policy Institute. And I do, once again, want to give me a plug for the forthcoming book, The College Dropout Scandal, because I think that's also going to reach university folks, college folks, and most importantly, parents and students.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. That's one word, a world that just might work. And Terrence McNally is TerrenceMcNally.net. And if you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to like 8 or 9 articles that sort of flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at T.E. McNally, M.C.N.A.L.L.Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, etc. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. And finally, thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. People need to know, A, what's good that's happening and what needs to happen. And finally, thank you, David Kirp. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.